the background for the writing or the occasion of this book. And I stated here the problem that I stated before. The life of Solomon was a great stumbling block to God's people, and it undoubtedly had adverse effect on the church. He was a man of wisdom. We see this. It's stated for us in Ecclesiastes that we just read. We know it from the historical text. Yet he was a man who, in his later life, departed from God and lived a life of shame. In this respect, he shown himself to be excessive, carnal, vain, lustful, an example of the things that God's children should not be. We know, of course, that he and his children after him were powerful. The history tells us of their tremendous power, and they could not be easily challenged. How then could the message of the people of God be published and understood in days like this? And I think that the Song of Solomon is at least one way in which the truth was maintained and declared to God's people. Now, the book contains, as I understand it, three primary characters. The Shulamite, the heroine of the story, the shepherd, the hero, and Solomon, who is the villain. In addition, we have the daughters of Jerusalem, who occasionally speak, as we'll note as we move along. The first verse says that the title of this is the Song of Songs, which is Solomon, or, as the Hebrew would read, literally to Solomon, belonging to Solomon, or pertaining to Solomon. Any of these meanings would be completely legitimate here. I suggest then that the title need not mean that Solomon is the author, but rather that it's a book about him, that it pertains to Solomon. He is a character and basically the occasion for the book. The setting of the book is given to us, as I understand it, in three different verses, in 2:7, and in 3:5, and in 8:4. And in all of these, we have basically this refrain: I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose or by the hinds of the field, that you stir not up nor awake my love until, and is it he, she, or it pleases? I suggest it should be she. The marginal note in my Bible, it translates it, he pleased. The marginal note says it can be it or she. The Hebrew is feminine. I can't understand why it shouldn't be she. Until she pleased. Now then, the setting would be, as I have suggested here, the Shulamite and the shepherd now are together and peaceful in a rural setting. Here the picture is of the shepherd watching over the Shulamite. She's safe. She's with him. She's asleep now. She is relaxed and at peace with him. The book would be then a kind of looking back at what happened prior to their being here together. It reflects on her having left her shepherd to live with Solomon for a time, and it tells how, while separated, the two sought one another until they were reunited. Now, I've given to you basically the outline of the story, and it has basically four scenes. The first three scenes are a kind of recapitulation of one another. The first scene is elaborated on in the second, and the third scene even more fully gives the detail and elaboration of the events that make up the story itself. So as we move along then, I'll try to call this to your attention. The first scene, which is from 1:2 to 2:7, basically is a scene which represents her, the Shulamite woman or girl, in Solomon's house. She has been lured from her shepherd, and in Solomon's house she reflects on her own unfaithfulness, and she longs for her shepherd. She inquires of others where he may be found. Now, this is the first part, then, of the scene, and it is from verses 2 to 7. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Thy love is better than wine. Thine oils have a goodly fragrance. Thy name is as oil poured forth. Therefore do the virgins love thee. Draw me, we will run after thee. The king hath brought me into his chambers. Here we have a clue to the setting. She's speaking now as she's in the chambers of the king. But her thoughts go out toward her shepherd. We will be glad and rejoice in thee. We will make mention of thy love. I am black but comely, O ye daughters of Jerusalem. Here again the setting would seem to be in Jerusalem. As the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon, look not upon me because I am swarthy, because the sun has scorched me. My mother's sons were incensed against me. They made me the keeper of the vineyard. Here there's a rural aspect, and we'll see all the way through that basically her terminology and that of the shepherd is rural, as over against much of Solomon's speech and terminology, which pertains to wealth and riches and jewels and city life. But note here in verse 6, they made me, as my brothers made me, keeper of the vineyards, but mine own vineyard have I not kept. And here I submit as a clue to the whole problem. Later on we'll see also something about the vineyard being likened to her own body. And so the vineyard here, I would understand in her reference, would be to her own body. I have not kept my body clean, pure, for my shepherd. Tell me, O thou whom my soul lovest, where thou feedest thy flock, where thou makest it to rest at noon. Why should I be as one that is veiled? Why should I be a member of the harem? Why should I be part of the harem here in Solomon's house, in the king's chambers? I don't belong here. This, in essence, is what she is saying. Now, the second part of scene one is simply a refrain from the daughters of Jerusalem, which is addressed to the Shulamite girl. If thou know not, O thou fairest among women, go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock, and feed thy kids beside the shepherd's tent. In other words, if you're looking for a shepherd, you don't find him here in the city. You go out where shepherds are, out where they feed their flock. He's where you would expect him to be. Then the next section of this scene, verses 9 through 11, are a quotation from her, perhaps, of Solomon's allurements to her. Note here, for instance, the wealth terminology that is to be seen here. I have compared thee, O my love, to a steed in Pharaoh's chariot. Thy cheeks are comely with plates of hair, thy neck with strings of jewels. We will make thee plates of gold with studs of silver. It sounds like Solomon. Silver, gold, jewels, steeds of Pharaoh's chariots. Who would know more about these things than Solomon? And he is wooing her now. And she simply is reflecting on his allurement, as in her heart she still desires her shepherd. Now then, verses 12 through 14, while she's at the king's table, reflects further on her shepherd and her love for him. Note again the rural terminology. While the king sat at his table, my spikenard sent forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me as a bundle of myrrh that lies between my breasts. My beloved is unto me as a cluster of henna flowers in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Now then, from 15 on, we have an interchange of he and she, he talking and she talking. Again, it seems to be a reflection on conversations that have been had between her and her shepherd. She thinks on the exchange that they've had at an earlier time. Again, note the rural terminology, and this goes from 1:15 through 2:6. First, he speaks in verse 15, and we know who is speaking on the basis, as I said, of the Hebrew pronoun. Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thine eyes are as doves. She responds, behold, thou art fair, my beloved, yea, pleasant. Also, our couch is green. The beams of our house are cedars, and our rafters are firs. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. He speaks, as a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. She speaks, as the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down under his shadow with great delight. His fruit was sweet. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Stay ye with me, raisins. Refresh me with apples, for I am sick from love. His hand, his left hand is under my head. His right hand embraces me. Now this is the close of the first scene, and it would seem to reflect then her longing and desires and her conversation with him. And you can see here that in stark contrast to the streets of Jerusalem, the king's chambers, the king's table, she's describing here her conversation with her shepherd from verses 15 to the end. A rural setting, a rural house. Our beams are cedar, our rafters are firs, and the green velvet grass is our couch. Now in verse 7 we have the end of the scene, which is this refrain that really marks out the separate scenes of the book, and which also gives us the proper setting here that I started out with. Now, the second scene begins in verse 8 and goes through 3-5. And it is an elaboration on the details of her experience with her shepherd, which we've already had introduced here in the first scene. And first of all, verses 10 to 14, first of all, verses 8 and 9 deal with a reflection on her having heard her shepherd's voice calling her to leave Solomon and come back to him. The voice of my beloved, he comes, leaping upon the mountains, skipping on the hills. My beloved is like a roe, a young hart. He stands behind our walls. He looks in at the windows. He glances through the lattice. The picture here is of his coming up, the shepherd seeking her. He looks for her. He finds her walled in. He finds her behind windows. She's not out in the open anymore. Seemingly a reflection then on her having been brought into the chambers of Solomon, which we saw in the first scene. Now, the second part of the second scene, verses 10 to 14, here she seems to be quoting the invitation of her shepherd to come with him. My beloved spake and said to me, quote, rise up, my love, my fair one, come away, for lo, the winter's past, the rain's over, the flowers appear on earth, the time of the singing of the birds has come. The voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land, the fig tree ripens her green figs. The vines are in blossom, and they give their fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair, come away, my dove, that are in the cleft of the rock, in the covert of the steep place. Let me see thy countenance, let me hear thy voice, for sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely. This is his call to her to come out from that place and come back where they had loved one another and known one another and shared the beauties of nature together. Now she gives an answer to his call, and it's an affirmative answer. She expresses her desire to go with him in verses 15 to 17. Again, note the rural terminology. Take us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine and I am his. He feeds his flock among the lilies. Till the day be cool and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be thou like a roer, a young hart on the mountains. Now, in 3:1-4, she reflects on her having sought her shepherd until she found him and married him. And this, again, is a kind of look at the ultimate conclusion to the whole story. She looks first in the city. Finally, she inquires of the watchman where he might be, and ultimately she finds him. By night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. I said, I'll rise now and go about the city, in the streets, in the broadways. She's going to leave the chambers of Solomon now, the city in which she lived, Jerusalem, the streets. I sought him, but I found him not. The watchman that goes about the city found me. To whom I said, saw ye him whom my soul loves? It was but a little that I passed from them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. The picture here then is of a beautiful conclusion. She seeks her lover. She finally finds him after seeking him. And this is the end then of scene two, with the same refrain we saw in 2:7. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, and so forth. Now scene three is the long scene. It's from 3:6 to 8:4. And it's the greatest detail and elaboration of the story. But it's basically the same story all over again. And it begins, first of all, with a description of Solomon's first having met her, apparently, when she was allured away from her shepherd. Apparently, as Solomon came through the rural sections, he lured her away from her shepherd and brought her to his harem. Now, this is told in 3:6 through 11. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the powders of the merchant? The riches are just oozing out here. Behold, it's the litter of Solomon. 70 mighty men are about. They all handle the sword and are expert in war. Every man has his sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. I'm not sure, but what that last phrase may be something of a slap at Solomon. Here he is guarded by 60 men around his litter, or whatever you want to call the car of state that he has here. Palanquin is it in my translation. King Solomon made himself a palanquin of the wood of Lebanon. He made the pillars thereof of silver, the bottom thereof of gold, the seat of purple. It sounds just like Solomon's building his own house, you remember, in the temple. The midst thereof being paved with love, perhaps a reference to the harem itself. Go forth, O ye daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon, with the crown wherewith his mother hath crowned him. Another strange expression, maybe not altogether complimentary. In the day of his espousals, in the day of the gladness of his heart. Now then, the next part of scene three, verses 1 to 15, are an elaboration on Solomon's seduction of the Shulamite girl. Now you can compare this with 9 through 11 of chapter 1. There it was very brief. I've compared thee, O my love, to the steed in Pharaoh's chariots and so forth, and thy neck to jewels and so forth. This is an elaboration then on his wooing of her and seducing her to come with him. Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thine eyes are as doves. Thy hair is a flock of goats. Thy teeth like a flock of ewes. Thy lips are like a thread of scarlet. Thy mouth is comely. Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate. Thy neck like the Tower of David. Thy two breasts are like two fawns. Until the day be cool and the shadows flee away, I will get me to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. Now he invites her then, after describing all of the parts of her body very beautifully, now he invites her to come with him. Thou art fair, my love. There is no spot in thee. Come with me from Lebanon. That is, from the rural area. Come with me from Lebanon. And thou hast ravished my heart, my sister, my bride, with one of thine eyes, with one chain of thy neck. How fair is thy love, my sister. How much better is thy love than wine. Thy lips, O my bride, drop as a honeycomb. Honey and milk are under thy tongue. The smell of thy garments is like the smell of Lebanon. A garden shut up is my sister, my bride. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Thy shoots are an orchard of pomegranates. And he goes on to describe her as like a garden or are a fountain of gardens here in verse 15. Thou art a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and flowing streams from Lebanon. He likes everything he sees about her. She's very beautiful, very desirable. He wants her. Now, verse 16 is her response. She yields. In 4:16, awake, O north wind, and come south. Blow upon my garden that the spices may flow out. Let my beloved come into his garden and eat his precious fruits. You remember in chapter 1, verse 6, there we had the statement from her, my own vineyard have I not kept. And this seems to be her yielding to him. He has painted her as a beautiful garden, and he wants to come and partake of her fruit. And here she says, come and partake. Then in chapter 5, verse 1, we see his actual indulgence. I am come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh and my honeycomb, and have drunk my wine with my milk. But then listen to what he says. Eat, O friends, drink ye, yea, drink abundantly. It's as if he's inviting others also to enjoy her beauty. Now in following here, the next part of this third scene, verses 2-8, basically here she is in Solomon's house, much as we saw her in chapter 2, verses 8-14. She hears her shepherd's voice calling her. She's been brought from the rural area now. She's yielded to Solomon. She's gone to his place. And she's separated from her shepherd. She hears him coming after her. She hesitates, though, when she hears his voice. She makes excuses at first. And then when she does go after him, as when she opens the door to him, he's gone. And she immediately seeks him in the streets and looks desperately for him. It's really a recapitulation of what we saw in chapters 2 and 3. I was asleep. My heart waked. It is the voice of my beloved. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled, for my head is filled with dew. My locks are the drops of the night. She hears her beloved saying these things to her. Now her excuse. I've put off my garment, how shall I put it on? I've washed my feet, how shall I defile them? I'm already in bed, don't bother me. But then, my beloved put his hand by the hole of the door, an opening in the door, and she can see his hand even reaching in to unlock the door. My heart was moved for him. I rose to open to my beloved. My hands dropped with myrrh and my fingers with liquid myrrh. Perhaps an allusion, alluding here to the smell of Solomon, and her love with Solomon was still upon her hands, the myrrh and the things associated with him. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had withdrawn. He was gone. My soul failed me when he spake. I sought him, but I could not find him. This again reflects what we saw in 3:2, where she was seeking for him and could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. The watchmen that go about the city found me. You remember that she's already mentioned the watchmen in 3:3. But here she gives more detail. They smote me. They wounded me. The keepers of the wall took away my mantle. They treated her mean and roughly when she sought after her lover. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick for love, from love. And then the refrain of the daughters of Jerusalem in verse 9. What is thy beloved more than any other, O thou fairest among women? What is thy beloved more than another, that thou dost so adjure us? In other words, what's so special about him that you would leave Solomon's glory for him? And her answer, verse 10 following, my beloved is white and ruddy, the chiefest among 10,000. His head is as the most fine gold, his locks are bushy and black as a raven, his eyes are like doves beside the water. His cheeks are as a bed of spices. His lips are lilies dropping liquid myrrh. His hands are as rings of gold. His body as ivory work. His legs are as pillars of marble set upon sockets of fine gold. His aspect is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend. Note the tenderness there, my friend. She describes him in both rural and terms of the glory of Solomon, as if to say he has everything Solomon has and a whole lot more. And then in 6:1, the refrain of the daughters, whither is thy beloved gone, O thou fairest among women? Whither has thy beloved turned him, that we may seek him with thee? If he's all that wonderful, we want to see him too. And so she gives in the next two verses, she discovers where her shepherd is. My beloved has gone down to his garden to feed in the gardens among the lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies. She desires her lover and she her shepherd, and she describes him. She knows now where he is and where to look for him. But now, in the meantime, in verse 4 following, we have what seems again to be one of Solomon's speeches luring her. Apparently, as she's seeking now for her lover, Solomon is trying to woo her back. He's trying to lure her back to him. Thou art fair, my love, as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem. The shepherd would never say that. He uses the rural terminology. He'd never say she was as comely as Jerusalem. Terrible as an army with banners. Turn away thine eyes from me. They have overcome me. Thy hair is as flock of goats. Thy teeth, thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate. There are 70 queens and 40 concubines and virgins without number. That is, he's referring here to his harem. But my beloved is the only one of her mother. She's the choice, and you're the fairest in the whole harem, and I don't want to lose you. The daughter saw her and called her blessed. Yea, the queens and concubines praised her. Now, verse 11, he describes his going to her. I went down to the garden of nuts to see the green plants of the valley, to see whether the vine budded. Before I was aware, my soul set me among the chariots of my princely people. Here he's talking in kingly terminology. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon thee. Note the we again. He seems to want to share her beauty with his friends. One's reminded here of Vashti and the attempts of the king to get her to show her beauty to his friends. Verse 11 is the refrain of the daughters of Jerusalem, but now rebukingly toward Solomon. Why will ye look upon the Shulamite as upon the dance of Mahanaim? Why will you make her a spectacle? Why will you put her on display? They are really rebuking him for this. Then we have Solomon's further lustful description of her. He describes her feet, her rounded thighs, her body, her waist, her breast, her neck, her nose, her head, her hair of hair. He sweeps her off his feet. He tries to with his same terminology he used before. Dwelling particularly upon the beauties of her body. And then he says, verse 9 of 7, thy mouth is like the best wine that goeth down smoothly for my beloved, gliding through the lips of those that are asleep. I can't help but think of Proverbs 23:31 there, where the same words are used as a warning about how wine slips down through the lips smoothly and its end is to destroy you. He thinks of himself partaking of her beauty here in such a way as this. Then finally, in 7:10 on into chapter 8, we have her refusal to yield to Solomon now. She will no longer yield as she once did. She affirms her love for her shepherd. She thinks of his call to her and her desire to go to him. She affirms vehemently, I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see whether the vine hath budded, the pomegranates. There will I give thee my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance,
fragrance. She mentions the precious fruits. Verse in chapter 8, "Oh, that thou wert as my brother that sucked the breast of my mother. When I should find thee without, I would kiss thee, yea, and none would despise me. I would lead thee and bring thee to my mother's house." Here again, the recapitulation of what we saw in 3:4. More detail. "Who would instruct me? I would cause thee to drink of spiced wine, of juice of my pomegranate. His left hand should be under my head, and his right hand should embrace me." Again, comparable with 2:6. The end of this scene, finally, "As the others, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem," and so forth. The fourth and final scene, from 8:5 to the end of the book, states the triumphs of the shepherd and the Shulamite, their triumph over Solomon's allurements. She sees herself returning with her shepherd, rejecting Solomon's attempts to buy her love. Note first of all, 5-7. "Who is this that comes up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? Under the apple tree I awakened thee. There thy mother was in travail with thee, and there she in travail that brought thee forth. Set me as a seal on thy heart, as a seal upon thine arm. For love is strong as death, jealousy is cruel as Sheol, a very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it." This is in praise of true love here. She is convinced of the love that she had for her shepherd, triumphing over that false love of Solomon that lasted but did not satisfy, lasted for a short time. "If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, he would utterly be contemned." And this would seem to be a sharp rebuke toward Solomon. Now, verses 8-12 are thinking back on her earlier days when she lacked any beauty as a child, was not attractive then to men. And she compares Solomon's gaudy glory to her own true happiness now. She utterly rejects Solomon's allurements and his way of life. "We have a little sister." Now, this would be her brothers talking. She's thinking about what they had said. "She has no breast. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken for? If she be a wall, we will build upon her a terret of silver. If she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar." In other words, if she's standoffish, if she shuts herself in, we'll do something to beautify her. If, on the other hand, she is too free and too open with her life, then we will protect her. We'll build a wall around her. "I am a wall in my breast like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one that found peace. Solomon had a vineyard. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Every one for the fruit was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, shalt have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof 200. In other words, Solomon, you've tried to buy love. You are rich and wealthy, and you keep your silver. You keep your riches. I'm going with my love. It's a rebuke to Solomon and a rejection of his wealth. And then finally, the scene is a closing exchange of words of love between the shepherd and the Shulamite. First, he speaks in verse 13, "Thou that dwellest in the gardens, the companions hearken for thy voice. Cause me to hear it." And she says, "Make haste, my beloved, and be thou like to a roe and to a young hart upon the mountains of spices." Now, having gone through the four scenes and the way it develops as I have understood it, I see the interpretation of the book as follows. The purpose of the book, as I've written it here at the bottom of page 2, is to contrast Solomon's way of life and that of God's faithful children. It's a contrast, which can be also said of a contrast between carnal love and true love. He was apparently attracted only to her fleshly, bodily aspects and wanted even to show those off to his friends.
And that contrasted with the true love that expressed between her and her shepherd. However, I think there's more to the message than that. It's not just a thesis on love, but it tells the story of God's faithfulness to his people. Like the shepherd, he keeps looking for his people. He will not forget them. He will not desert them. Though they have parted from him and have lived a life that's contrary to his will, he keeps calling them back from the irreligious ways of Solomon. In this case, the shepherd then would represent the Lord. The Shulamite would represent God's people, who, as history has already revealed to us, were lured away by false prophets to a false kind of life, but whom God determined to redeem, saying that I will have a remnant, and he called them back to himself. Solomon then would represent himself, and those who like him would seek to lead by example or by words God's people away from the Lord. I see then again this book as Ecclesiastes, a book intended to be a message to God's people in extremely hard times, when all the power, all of the great influence, all of the majority of the leadership was drawing the people away from God, was faithless. Comparable to the latter days of Solomon. And in order to bring a message to the people in a time like this, the call back, by means of this drama, which might not have been easily understood by many of the readers, but which should have been understood by those who were seeking God. There's a message here that I think would clearly go through to God's people. It's much like the book of Revelation in that sense. Much in the book of Revelation makes no sense or would make no sense to an unbeliever. But to God's people, it says a great deal. You remember what happened when Jeremiah wrote very plainly. The king took it and cut it into little pieces. Perhaps this was written this way to protect it, so that it wouldn't be cut up in little pieces. Solomon even could read it and not be sure what it meant. At least it was possible. Probably this was not written in Solomon's day. Probably it was written sometime afterwards. But at a time when, as we see the pattern of things in the early kings of Judah, after they've divided from Israel, there was a continual living like Solomon had lived, not doing God's will. The first two or three kings, you may recall, Rehoboam and his sons, lived very much as Solomon had lived. And we can imagine that its influence was terrible against the people. All right, let's pause then for some. No, I don't think it represents, well, it represents the real situation. I don't think it represents anything that happened. It's a poetic expression of the truth that the prophets themselves had been preaching. It, as I have tried to analyze it, I see it as exactly the same message that the prophets were bringing. It's supplementary to that. It's basically saying to God's people, do not be lured by these false prophets and the false representations of what is good. See God as one who loves you and to whom you must return. Now that's what the prophets said over and over. Another question? Ron, did you have one? Anyone else? Yes.
Why is it in the allusion to when the shepherd says, my sister, and she says, my brother, and
I don't know that I can answer that. I would say simply the terms brother and sister here in an affectionate way, I would assume. Expressions of fondness and affection.
In the last line or two of verse 13, chapter 6, I didn't exactly get your translation. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies?
Yeah. As upon the dance of Mahanaim, literally, is the way it is. which can mean two companies of people. Well, the first part of that verse is still part of his speech. He's still saying, return, return to me, Shulamite. Return so that we may look upon thee. He's still trying to keep her there. And then, rebukingly, the daughters of Jerusalem say, why will you look upon the Shulamite? Why do you want to do this thing? As upon the dance of Mahanaim. Now this, I'm not sure exactly what it means. The two companies could refer to her two breasts. It could be just an allusion to the fact that she would be exposed there, her beauty exposed to the friends of Solomon and Solomon. What else it could mean, I really don't know. The dance before the two companies, I don't know really what else it could mean. But the point is that he wants her to come back so he can enjoy her beauty. And here the daughters of Jerusalem rebukingly say, well, why do you want to do this thing? Rebuking her, rebuking Solomon.